The medical program on Radio Islam, your station to knowledge.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuhu. Welcome to the medical program here on Radio Islam International. The medical program is brought to you by the Islamic Medical Association of South Africa, or IMASA as it is better known. And this evening we are focusing on major depressive disorder and suicide. Now my guest tonight is Dr. Zubair Muller. He is a seasoned expert in the field of psychiatry with several years of experience behind him, having trained in the UK and gained experience in many aspects, or in all aspects, of psychiatry. He has been in private practice here in South Africa in Durban since 2011, and he advocates a holistic approach to dealing with mental health problems. And this evening, as I said, we are going to be talking about major depressive disorder and suicide. Having just, I think, had Suicide Day quite recently, or a week that we look at or create awareness for these particular mental disorders that we are talking about this evening. Dr. Zubair Muller, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Welcome to the show.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Shukran for having me on the program.
Afwan, I know, I'm not sure if you are in a part of Durban where there's load shedding at the moment, but I'm just checking so we know that everything is going to be easy and we don't have any issues, because I am, and I'm hoping that we can keep the the show going until 9 o'clock, due to the fact that load shedding sometimes causes connectivity issues as well.
Shukran, I'm okay on my side for the moment.
Alhamdulillah. All right, so remember, listeners, that it is an interactive program and we would appreciate your calls or even text messages that you can send through to us pertaining to the topic that we're discussing this evening, which is major depressive disorder and suicide. The number to call is 011-854-1548. I'll repeat that, 011-854-1548. Or you can send your messages through to WhatsApp on 072-786-1548. That's 072-786-1548. So, Dr. Muller, we're talking about major depressive disorder and suicide, two very important topics that we're dealing with, and something that people don't really talk about because it's sometimes viewed as being taboo. And people find it difficult to talk about these subjects, and yet it's so very important for us to create awareness and discuss these issues, because there seems to be an increase, particularly with the pandemic having hit us 2 years ago, almost going on 3 years soon, and we've seen how mental illness became quite prevalent during this time. So maybe if you could start by telling us how common and serious suicide is amongst firstly our Muslim community and then broader South African community as well.
Shukran. So as you mentioned, we're looking at two aspects. We're looking at depression, or in terms of the clinical term, major depressive disorder and suicide. So just to give a bit of clarification before we go on in terms of what major depressive disorder is. So really what it means is that you've got symptoms which have been there for some time, which impact on your functioning. You have to have all three to have a clinical diagnosis of major depressive disorder. But briefly, you would have the symptoms as changes in mood, including low mood, irritable, anxious mood, sometimes having a numb a mood, which is emotionally numb. Then there could be changes in sleep, appetite, energy, concentration, enjoyment, motivation, drive, and very importantly, that is that part of the symptoms of a clinical major depressive episode is that you can have suicidal ideation. So we're talking about suicidal ideation, where there are thoughts about suicide, and it's on a spectrum. So we're looking at a few things. We're looking at suicidal ideation. Do I have thoughts about suicide? And next, suicidal intent. intent, meaning I think I am going to do something. And the last part is a suicidal plan. And then when we reach that stage, we know that things are quite serious. But just to answer you in terms of, so I don't have recent figures. It's something which is really difficult to get good figures, especially in so-called developing countries, because of the misclassification of suicide. Sometimes it's misclassified as injury or as homicide or as something else. But really, it is on the increase. So these figures are from a few years ago. But really, what it's showing is that suicide is the third leading cause of death in the age group 10 to 25 years old. It's much more common in terms of males than in females. Females tend to attempt suicide more, and males complete suicide more. One of the few things that males commit to, I think, unfortunately. But so we're looking at approximately really 25% of deaths in the younger people, 15 to 25, that have been shown to be suicide. So it's something which is on the increase. But you also look at it in terms of, as you can see, the age group. And what we found is that the at the extremes of age, you know, the younger age, that is that there's an increased risk, and also in the older population. So you're looking at those 60, 65, and over. Although I think a lot of people these days would consider themselves young if they are 65. But what we find with older people again is that there isn't what you call an attempted suicide, but there's more a completed suicide. So there are a few things we look at here. There's a few things we look at in suicide which give us an idea in terms of the severity of the suicidal of the attempt of the suicide. And with elderly people, we find that completed suicide, as we call it, is quite high. So just to give you an idea, approximately 10% of the population are elderly, but 25% of all completed suicides occur in the elderly. So there's about a 3 times increased risk as opposed to sort of younger, middle-aged people. So again, just to summarize it, basically, it is a major problem. It's and it's a major problem in certain groups as well, specifically.
All right. You did mention groupings, and one of them that you mentioned was that there's a higher prevalence amongst males rather than females when it comes to the completion of a suicide rather than the attempts of suicide. But what really got my attention was the fact that you said 10, and I'm thinking to myself, why would a 10-year-old want to, you know, get to a stage where they would actually look at taking their own life? I can understand somebody being older, particularly when you look at older people, life can jade you. You know, you go through so many things in life, some people more than others. Some people handle things more differently from others, and people have different, you know, rates of tolerance and that kind of thing. So you can understand that, you know, people sometimes cannot make it any longer, and the thought of suicide is almost like the only solution for them. But for a 10-year-old child, what would be the reason that they would choose to commit suicide?
So this is an interesting question, and I think it would need quite a long time to explain all of the reasons, because it's here. So we're looking really at depression and other mental health conditions in younger people, and the fact is that younger people these days are more exposed to a large, you know, to many more stresses at an earlier age. They might be exposed to things that they are not ready for in terms of social media, for example. But again, we're also looking at really different socioeconomic groups. So more of the reason would be in terms of, you know, those that are disenfranchised, younger, homeless kids who at that point do not see the point in living. I mean, they don't have a good existence, really, and they might be involved with, as we'll see later, in terms of substance abuse, which greatly increases the risk of suicide. And though, so we're talking about completed suicide in these younger age groups, not always, of course, but more so in the lower socioeconomic groups, with a lack of support, increased risk of abuse, sexual abuse. And again, this is a bit of a generalization, I do know that, but more or less, these are the factors we're looking at. In the, if I can say, in the higher socioeconomic groups, it's more in terms of self-harm or an attempted suicide rather than a completed suicide. So I think once again, you know, because of the very nature of the country we live in, which is a so-called first world and third world country, we're looking at various statistics that have been merged together. But definitely it is a cause of concern. Like you mentioned, someone as young as that would even contemplate suicide.
But I suppose, you know, like you said, poverty can bring about this kind of thought. I mean, what is the purpose of living when you don't have a home to go to or family to turn to? There's no support system. And, you know, I mean, people living on the street, sometimes when you speak to people like that, you understand the severity of their situation and the direness of their situation. And for them, it may, you know, we don't have that experience. Alhamdulillah, we must be grateful for that. But for people who've lived most of their life, young people who've lived most of their lives on the street, I mean, for them, I can understand what would push them in that direction, particularly, as you said, in a third world country or in a developing country like South Africa itself, what they face today is very difficult. So I understand that, but it just seems quite, you know, difficult to absorb that a person that young would actually contemplate until you look at the circumstances that they face. But what are the risk factors then for suicide? What should we be looking out for if you are talking to someone or know somebody who maybe, you know, in a, at the time when they are contemplating, and you may pick up certain factors about them that could alert you to the fact that they may be planning or thinking about it?
Gee. So, again, this is a difficult question to answer for a few reasons. One is that it's a complex etiological cause, because one thing leads to another, which is unfortunately the norm with mental health. So whether it's depression leading to suicidal thoughts, and then in terms of, you know, losing your job because of the depression, for example, lack of family support. So really, it's one thing leads to another. But the other thing, which is actually a positive but a negative in some respects, is that suicide is a huge problem worldwide. But it still, fortunately, remains, you know, for the most part, a rare occurrence. So what that means is, you know, some of the figures that I quoted were in certain groups where the risk is much higher. But overall, the incidence of suicide, fortunately, although it is increasing, and, you know, we'll talk about that because of recent factors locally and also worldwide, is that it remains a rare occurrence, which means that, like a rare illness, we don't have that much information, because fortunately it doesn't occur that often. But so that's a good thing. But obviously, what that means is that we are still way behind, and we are trying for so many years as psychiatrists, especially forensic psychiatrists, trying to find out what would distinguish one person from another. You've got someone with depression, and you've got someone else, similar symptoms. Why is the one more likely to go on to committing or and attempting a suicide? So what we have are a few indications that there's an increased risk. So first of all, it may sound a bit strange for me to say it, but to have a mental illness would put you at an increased risk of suicide. That sounds strange to say, but what that implies is that there are a few suicides where there is no past history of or a recent history of mental illness, or if there is, it wouldn't explain the severity. So obviously something else is going on, whether it's a personality a problem and an issue with the personality, whether it's just a hugely impulsive occurrence at that time in someone who has no past history, someone received, you know, really, really bad news and didn't even get depressed, which, you know, takes about a week or so. So really, by and large, though, we're looking at about 90% to 95% people having a mental illness. And then you might ask, obviously, which mental illness? And we are speaking about depression. But again, there's such an overlap, because the norm with mental health is that comorbidity is the norm. So it's very rare to get a pure depression or a pure anxiety or a pure substance use. But by and large, 70% of of cases involve someone who has been depressed, and then there's an increased then there's others in terms of alcohol where there's about a 15% contribution. But obviously, if you combine both the risks, it goes up. And then the other conditions, which we're not going to discuss today, but just to give you an idea, schizophrenia and other anxiety disorders, which are lower down the list. What we look at with depression is not just depression, but the kind of depression. So we have a depression called the old term is melancholic depression. This is a specific kind of depression where the mood is really, all the time low. There's a complete lack of enjoyment, emotionally numb, that kind of depression. But again, I'm going on about this, but in terms of substance use, greatly increases the risk of suicide in the long term, but also at that time. At that time, you're depressed, you're thinking to yourself, I think I'm going to do something. If you don't use, we're not talking about alcohol or anything only, we're talking about over-the-counter medication that might affect you as well. And that at that point, what they found is most of the time when there's a completed suicide, there's been some sort of substance abuse, whatever it might have been, whether it exacerbated the impulsivity, whether it's disinhibited the person. There are a few other things as well which are not related to what we're speaking about today, like you mentioned, personality disorders, that sort of thing. And then in terms of anxiety disorders, which normally contribute but don't actually are not a hugely significant factor on their own. And really, like we said before, is we're looking at someone who is depressed, who has been depressed, and then there's other contributory factors as well.
All right. Now, looking at specific groups of people, are there any, you mentioned males are more prone to committing suicide, but what other, which other groups would you be looking at where we see an increased risk of suicide as well?
So like we said, males are less likely to attempt suicide, but unfortunately more likely to complete suicide. And females, obviously, the opposite of that. And the reason for that, which I must say has been changing, women, again, like I always say, want to be equal to men, but in the wrong stuff as well, so to speak, is that men attempt violent methods. Hanging, shooting, that sort of thing. So, unfortunately, the risk of completing the suicide and is much higher. It's not that with females, it's usually overdosing. That's it, or those. That's the most common one. But if you're looking at other special groups, I would actually classify patients with what you call deliberate self harm or self. Injurious behavior, we say. So with deliberate self-harm, these are patients who either attempt suicide, but there's a likelihood that it was not a true attempt, or there was some doubt in their attempt. Not that it was an attention-seeking or anything, but just that they had doubts about it. So they may have maybe taken an overdose, but then called someone because they had regrets about it, or that. Also, we're talking about self-harm where there's a significant cutting, for example, which is not always associated with suicide, mind you. But we look at this because, like we said, we're trying to find out what are the risk factors, and we haven't found a clear association with many things. But what we found is that there's a 27 times increase of patients with self-harm who go on to completed suicide as opposed to the general population. So that's one group to look at. Against that, obviously, is that for every one person who self-harms or has a suicide an attempt, for every 100 people that would attempt suicide, only one would actually go on to completed suicide. So it's not only that if you self-harmed or if you try to kill yourself before that you are automatically at a higher risk. But looking at other groups, and again, we tried to break it down. We spoke about the socioeconomic data. So as you move down the socioeconomic ladder, so to speak, there's an increased risk of suicide. We also look at other factors that could be protective, and they found work and having a routine in terms of that is very, very protective in terms of suicide. Except in certain occupations, and unfortunately, doctors, psychiatrists are quite high up in that list. But you look at doctors, nurses, dentists, and it's not only in terms of the fact that they are much more depressed than the general population, but unfortunately, they have that they have the knowledge as to exactly what to take and in what doses to die. As opposed to the general, although the internet seems to be trying to level the playing field in that regard. Then there's other things in terms of policemen, lawyers, insurance agents, they say. So really we're looking at a certain subgroup where we want to be a bit more cautious. Because obviously the idea in the end is that we want to prevent as much as many suicide attempts and completed suicide as we can. So those are the main ones. We're also looking at people that are sort of unemployed, people that live in urban areas seem to be more at risk, although it's a bit of a gray area now. And then in terms of marital status seems to be protective, not always, because there is obviously a risk of domestic violence, grievous bodily harm, gender-based violence, but also in terms of social isolation, that's another risk factor. And of course, with COVID, that was that really put things into perspective where being socially isolated was the norm, and for some people, it was really difficult with the lack of support and family support. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Now, one of the things you mentioned was over-the-counter medicines, and recently we've been hearing a lot of codeine usage abuse, basically, amongst teens. And you're bringing up that made me realize that this could actually be one of the reasons why we see so many young people today maybe committing suicide as well, because of this abuse of substances like codeine. It's easy to get. I mean, from the research that was done recently, it's just buying a bottle of Bronchia over the counter and then mixing it with different either alcohol or other beverages in order to drink this without anybody knowing, because you can put it into a normal cool drink bottle. And this can give a person a sense of sort of like, you're not so inhibited anymore. So you basically make decisions that are not really good for you. And this for somebody who's already been planning or prone to depression or depressive states, like you've mentioned, this would make it easier for them to commit suicide?
Yes, a very good point. So what you're saying is absolutely right. In terms of codeine, it's not just codeine that we might have thought of in terms of Adcodol and, Sinaleve, and I don't want to get sued by anyone, but these are really ones that are very, very dangerous medications. And again, we find that there's a trend. Those might be more taken by the old thinking was, housewives, bored housewives kind of thing. But obviously, it's just anyone who gets addicted to that. But what you're saying is actually very true in terms of a combination of codeine in the form of cough mixture, Bronchia is one that you mentioned, which they then use which is basically, if you think about it, is a form of Woonga, because Woonga is heroin, which is an opiate as well. So this is where it comes from. So like you said, there's a few things. First of all, it decreases your, it causes more disinhibition when you mix that coupled with the depression that you're experiencing as a young homeless male, for example, and then also increase impulsivity as well. So that could explain a large amount of what's happening as well. And like in the US, I think they've taken huge steps to, try and, deal with the opiate crisis. I don't see that happening here in South Africa in terms of legislation, which is quite sad. But this is, it's a very good point that you raise as well.
All right, then we're looking, you spoke about, completed attempted suicide and completed suicide. And if we could maybe just, look at some of the methods of suicide and how these impact on completed suicide. You mentioned males committing more of the what we term as completed suicide. In other words, they are successful at completing a suicide. And the methods that they've used, either gun, which I think is one of the more easier ways to, because it's quick, messy as it may be, it's quick. Because, I mean, if somebody shoots themselves, depending on how they use the weapon, where they hold the weapon, it's bullets to the head and they're gone. For somebody who hangs themselves, it may be a little longer, but it means death. But for somebody like a young woman who decides either to slit her wrist or to maybe overdose, doesn't mean that they are going to die immediately. It doesn't mean that they would survive. Somebody may find them, or they don't take enough of the drugs or cause enough harm to themselves for them to actually die within a short space of time. Is that how you would basically, in layman's terms, explain attempted and a completed suicide?
Yes, absolutely. So so in terms of the figures, like I said, males are more, are four times more likely than females to have a completed suicide, and females are four times about the same figure than males to attempt suicide. And it's exactly what you said in terms of the method of suicide. And one of the things that we look at with this is, if you think about it, and maybe I'll talk about it as well a bit later in terms of what can we do about it, or what the interventions can be done.
Yes.
And again, as we can see, that the interventions are clearly much more than what a psychiatrist or the psychiatric or the mental health personnel can do only. So you're looking at social changes that need to take place. You're looking at gun legislation, but obviously appropriate gun legislation, availability of like we said, certain medications. You can go to pharmacies now and buy medication and go to another pharmacy. And I don't think that there's a combined linked network.
Yes.
whereas in other countries, because of the system and obviously that they're able to do it, that it would then red flag the person that you bought, 10 Panados, or you bought, 30 Panados or so, and now you're going to another pharmacy in 10 minutes or so. So there is that network. So very often it's just by luck that a pharmacist might call and tell you, this patient came in without a script and I just saw them last week. And, we can't rely on that thing. So one is availability of the substance, of the method, whether it's guns, whether it's medication, what kind of medication as well. Some medications, which I don't tell my patients, obviously, which ones are more likely to kill them. But when you go to a pharmacy, you need to be aware of this. Unfortunately, again, because of social networking, and in terms of, you get websites which actually tell you ball by ball how to do all of these things. Medication and what. Unfortunately, exactly. Yeah. One of the things that I meant to mention just a bit earlier was in terms of physical health. So we're talking about chronic physical illness, which is also a contributory factor to completed suicide. We're talking about chronic physical pain, whether in whatever form, whether it's arthritis, not only tone, obviously, combined with depression. We're also looking at chronic insomnia as well. So this is not just insomnia which occurs at the time of depression, but a chronic insomnia which can lead. And once again, these are contributory factors. I'm not saying if you don't sleep, you're gonna kill yourself. Those are the main things. There's a few other things people have tried to work out. Is there a certain season that people are more likely to be sad, as in seasonal affective disorder, they call that, or in terms of suicide. But this holds true more for countries that have a distinct season, unlike South Africa or in Durban, as you can see. There isn't a clear change from winter to summer kind of thing. Yeah.
So when we look at impact, what would impact on a person so much that they would want to commit suicide? And one of the things today, obviously, social influences. What are some of the social influences that we look at that can actually lead people to contemplating suicide?
So again, this is such a huge problem, because obviously it can be a positive and a negative, and we know lots of negative influences, and people have been talking about this and teasing out exactly how things are now in terms of the world, in terms of social media, TikTok, and all of these things, where it's all about attention seeking. It's all about me, which means that people are sometimes are unable to deal with stresses that they should be able to, or they are told that they don't have to, or they externalize blame, or they are influenced much more than even 10 years ago by celebrities' influences. Previously, it was more in terms of how the media would report certain things. You read it in a newspaper, for example, or you talk to people, talk to your friends. I'm talking about younger people at school, but now it's everywhere. So I think that the huge companies do have a clear role in terms of controlling this. And I know that there's a big move in Europe and the US, I think, now as well, in terms of curbing Facebook and Google as well, that they have a social responsibility. So compared to I think even a few years ago when I did do a similar talk, even in the last few years, things have changed so much that you are influenced by so many things out there, and it's in the palm of your hand, unfortunately. But again, it's not all gloom and doom. I think from an Islamic point of view, if we can ground ourselves, it's actually, yeah, we can use these things to our benefit. We can sort of, mm-hmm, find appropriate whatever articles, videos on positivity, appropriate positivity on being resilient, that sort of thing. So that's so the media is one. And in terms of the other thing is really more specifically for South Africa is in terms of COVID. And we know that there's, like I said, many people thrived on that social interaction, especially the elderly as well. And it was a huge change for them. First of all, the world has changed, where there isn't that extended, yeah, family, it's more of an immediate nuclear family, and now there was even more in terms of alienation, so to speak. And then, of course, in terms of our situation with the flooding, the rioting, the consequences of all of these, including the COVID with regard to financial issues as well. So any kind of life event, I think it doesn't mean that you are going to, there's a host, it's like a perfect storm. Something happens, yeah, the way you analyze it can then cause you to become depressed. You can then, as we said, consequences from that, maybe substance use, maybe a lack of support. So we try to build up a picture when we see someone, in terms of what's the risk of suicide. Unfortunately, many people who are at risk of suicide or mental health do not seek help. And when they seek help, not in terms even of suicidal, because they may not be suicidal at that time, but in terms of depression, do not seek help at that time, and then they can't be identified. So that's where, public initiatives are very important. And again, these are lacking here in South Africa, whether it's, yes, at the clinic or like public drives. One last thing, just in terms of sort of social, is in terms of gender-based violence, which I think, is something we always have to talk about. We've been speaking about it for so long, and yet it seems to be South Africa, unfortunately, has one of the worst records in terms of, but this caused many people, many females, to become so suicidal that they don't see a way out.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. So how do we go about then to reduce the incidences of suicide amongst our communities?
But like we said before, we there are a few ways. One is people have tried to develop rating scales, trying to work out what's the person's risk. And they've tried to work out something which is dynamic. Because people, in terms of yourself, people change all the time. Want to know what's the, yes, risk of depression at that time, what's the risk in terms of jobs and everything else. But it's very, very clear, like we said, based that we can use actuarial measures to predict which groups are more at risk. But and our focus, unfortunately, needs to be the high-risk group, because we can't focus on everyone. And that holds true for any kind of screening, whether it's diabetes or, whatever else. But it's very, very clear that there's a need for an approach across the board. So, you need to you need to work mutually between psychiatrists and then first of all, psychiatrists and psychologists, other colleagues in terms of physicians, people. So wherever people come for help is where you want to identify and have some kind of, some kind of implementation. So you wouldn't expect a physician to be able to do a detailed suicide risk, just as I wouldn't be able to do what they do. But for them to have a kind of a basic approach, and then, or to have a high level of suspicion that that someone will be unwell. But again, like we've seen with all of the all of the risk factors, that there needs to be an approach from the from the health department, the social department, the government. There needs to be a clear strategy in terms of, small changes can lead to big changes. Alcohol, when at that time that it was banned during COVID, there was a huge improvement. I had some patients who I thought would never stop drinking, and they actually did drink that time. Well, they were forced to, none there, but they didn't go back to it. Yeah. So, small changes like that. So that's the first thing to say, really, is that it needs to be a holistic approach, and it's not a psychiatric problem only or a medical problem. It's a social health problem as well. And then, so yeah, so the first thing obviously that you want to identify who's at risk, you want to detect, you want to network. You have to network within the limits of privacy, and I won't talk this much about Poppy Act. You know, some of it doesn't make sense to me. And but anyway, you want to share information appropriately, basically. And then it's about, at the basic level, education, educating high-risk groups, you know, going to schools or, you know, that sort of thing. Having available resources instead of having to go to, like, a specialist psychiatrist or someone. Having someone you could just go to, you know, at a school or, like, have some kind of a framework where you can get help as well. Also, obviously, in terms of stigma as well, that's quite important. People don't talk about mental health, and the first time that they would talk about it is when they are acutely suicidal, for example. Another very important, like we said, sort of gatekeeper, so to speak, would be GPs, general practitioners, because people you know, generally go to a GP much more than they would see a psychiatrist. So that could be where they could alert other people. But again, you know, the whole health system is under strain, whether it's the public health or the private sector as well. But again, this is where we try to liaise, and hopefully with the, you know, with medicine moving into the technological era, which, you know, took a long time, there will be good interaction in terms of sharing of appropriately of notes and information as well. So that's on a primary level. Yeah, there's obviously a few more you know, levels that you can work on to identify. So basically, whatever was the cause, you want to identify, you want to treat. But they've also shown that one of the factors was that once you've identified someone has been depressed, someone is depressed, whether it's a GP who identifies or a psychiatrist, and they you know, clearly are you know, have had history of suicidal ideation, what they found is that still a huge amount of them are not inadequately treated. It means that they aren't on the appropriate treatment that the right dose. Whether it's because of the, you know, whatever cost, or whether it's because of the person that doesn't want to take the medication. But this again is quite important, because this, as you decrease each of the symptoms of depression, it has a knock-on effect. If your energy is better, you can then sort of go out and do something. You're more likely to get a job. Your motivation is better. You're not at home. You're socializing. Immediately, the risk of suicide decreases. So one thing leads to another. And then obviously, appropriate psychological treatment as well. And there's a huge host of appropriate focused psychotherapy that is on these days as well. So I think that's important in terms of, so if you get the mental health point of view, something else which they found as well is that important is follow up after you've been discharged. So when a person with depression is admitted, the first 2 weeks, they say, are crucial, even if it's a follow up with a telephonic follow up or WhatsApp follow up. So it's quite important, because that's an important time in terms of when they might be at increased risk of suicide. Yes. But really, and the last thing I suppose is when it's also talking now more or less in terms of how can we reduce the incidence in terms of the mental health, the depression point of view. Another thing would be in terms of when patients go to casualty. Very often they would sort of slip through the, you know, through the system. They would be seen by a locum who's there, and they would be sent home, or there wouldn't be any kind of follow up. So we need to again try to see where we can intervene as effectively as possible.
All right. I think those are such important things. And right now, as you said, you know, with the health system being strained the way it is, and also with all the changes that are being made, you know, people talking about the NHI and things like that, it also brings about a bit of uncertainty amongst people who use it. Often, I mean, when you think about chronic patients with chronic illnesses, many of them during COVID, cancer patients, their treatments were sort of put on the back burner because there were more people treated for COVID rather than seeing to people like that. And obviously, this has impacted on their mental health as well. Mental health patients who weren't seen to because they either couldn't get there due to the fact that we were under such a strict lockdown, you know, then their medications weren't given to them on time. And many times you find that people from the older groups as well, not knowing how to take their medication because they either forget or, you know, unsure, not understanding what's been said to them. And then being on their own sometimes is some of the reasons why we see them becoming, you know, although they're getting treatment for the mental illness they may be going through, or even a chronic illness for that matter, they aren't really keeping to the regimen that's been put in place. And this could lead them to them not getting better, but rather the situation worsening because of that. And then, you know, you've you've dealt with the fact that obviously the medical system needs a change, but that's not going to happen immediately, but it is slowly getting there, especially with the advances in technology. But when we look at people at home now, you know, during COVID, we saw how death within the family affected people. People lost many family members in one go sometimes. Sometimes it was the head of the family, sometimes it was the mother, or who could have been the head of the family, sometimes it was siblings, grandparents, and that really affected people. Now, when we talk about suicide, I'm sure the effect is just as debilitating to the family, but it has a different sort of effect because it also leaves people feeling guilty. Obviously, you know, because you keep asking yourself, what could I have done to stop this person from going ahead with something like that?
Yeah, absolutely. So this is something which is really difficult to see. And, you know, I know that it's not possible, but I wish sometimes that the person who had, you know, killed themselves. And fortunately, I haven't had, you know, too many of those unfortunate incidents. But if the person could actually see how it impacts on the family, and actually they found this to be a protective factor. For example, if someone is contemplating suicide and someone that they know, someone close to them, you know, does commit suicide, and they see what the impact it is on their on that person's family. So once again, there's so many emotions going through the family's mind at the same time. First of all, if it was just a normal bereavement, that in itself has so many emotions. Yes. There's grief, but you know, there would be maybe ambivalent, or there would be guilt, inappropriate guilt. But this is now exacerbated and amplified when it's someone who has committed suicide. So you can have like responses which obviously would include grief, but would be remorse at the same time, anger towards the person. And this is something that I try to get my patients to see, that you can actually have multiple emotions at one, and you need to tease them out. And most importantly, what can I do about it? And then they themselves are at risk of depression as well because of this. Like I said, there would be guilt, shock, the acceptance. You know, there are the various stages that you may go through in terms of grief, but now take much longer before you reach a level of acceptance. There's always a question of why. Sometimes, and this sort of goes against what I just said earlier on as well, is sometimes it's a sense of relief. Very, very rarely, where the person was in, for example, a chronic pain or, you know, that sort of thing. I mean, it's not something that, from an Islamic point of view, we know what our views are. But just to put that out there as well. Sometimes if there was obviously a history of mental illness and the parent or the spouse, whatever, didn't acknowledge it appropriately, there might be, again, inappropriate guilt. And we have to help the family deal with this as well. And there are ways of doing it, of course, in terms of psychological approaches.
Mm-hmm. Now, one of the other things, and I know this is a very controversial and touchy topic, is assisted suicide. What are your thoughts with regards to assisted suicide?
So first of all, from a legal point of view, it's not legal in most countries. I think only Switzerland, and I'm not sure which other country it's legal. And I think you might have read recently about this, I think, French person who went to, well, you know, sort of a director or something who actually went. So, you know, it becomes topical every now and then. But again, you've got to look at it from a holistic point of view. So first of all, according to the law, if you assist someone, that is, you are likely to be punished by the law. Whether it's homicide or assisted homicide or, you know, whatever it might be. So I think once again, to get a balance, to understand that this person is going through a huge amount of, you know, emotional trauma, physical trauma it may be as well. But at the same time, you have to determine what is the capacity from a legal point of view. There's the ways of working out what, you know, do you have a capacity to decide on this? So you have to work out many, many things. What's the person's, first of all, what is their cognitive state? And even in terms of depression, that can impact on on your cognitive state. You may not be thinking clearly because of the depression. You see things worse than they are, etc., etc. So my view is that it's very, very difficult for you to have capacity to make a decision to say, I want to kill myself. And if you have that, and if you have that capacity, it then implies that you don't have a significant mental illness. And then that's again something else altogether in terms of in terms of how the world is today as well. There might be a lack of support, communal support, religious support, that sort of thing as well. But Islamically, obviously, we know our view that would not be allowed in any circumstances. You may feel for the which is obviously different from someone where you are prolonging lives with artificially with a machine. This is not obviously what we are speaking about. But I think generally and I've seen this, and also studies have borne this out, that most people who are severely, well, they have a certain kind of depression called a dysthymia, which is a chronic, meaning more than sort of 2 years depression, which is there all the time, but sometimes worse. And they are very suicidal for years on end. What they found is that if you get them past that stage and they into their 30s or whatever, with medication, many of them actually are so glad that they didn't that they didn't kill themselves. So I make a kind of very blasé thing with my patient, but obviously it's very serious. So I tell them, if you don't kill yourself, you have a good prognosis. And this is not obviously, you know, taking it lightly. What it means is, obviously, like you said, if you get past that stage, you do have a good prognosis in the long term.
Mm-hmm. Well, we've almost come to the end. I think we've got like a minute left. Do you have any concluding thoughts that you'd like to share with us?
Shukran. So like I said, you know, it's quite, when it comes to suicide, it's something where the incidence is increasing. It has a multifactorial cause, and therefore a multifactorial approach in terms of treatment. There needs to be intervention, which is comprehensive at various levels, and then also in terms of how it affects the family. At the moment, our focus is on high risk groups, trying to identify first of all who's at risk and then trying to do something about it. But this is something where we need everyone's help. We need the help of the spouse, we need the help of the family, the help of the teacher, the help of the GP, the help of the whoever else might out be there. You know, be aware, know those around you, know yourself, know when there's a change in you, and seek help when it's required.
I think it's basically going back to the way things used to be years ago. We've become a society that's focused very much on ourselves, and also that sense of being in a village, you know, where everybody cared for everybody else, doesn't exist anymore. And I think going back to that, where people could see when somebody, you know, you knew your neighbor. So if you didn't see them, or when you saw them and they weren't looking very good that day, you would make the effort to find out, you know, is something wrong? Can I help? Today we don't have that kind of situation. I think many people are so focused on their own lives and what's going on with themselves that we don't stop to turn around and have a look at someone else and realize that that person may actually be going through a very difficult situation but hasn't had the ability to come out and say, I need help.
Absolutely right. And so, and you know, very well put, actually, very well put. That's exactly what has changed. I mean, we need to get that back in some way.
Yes. Well, Jazakallah khair for your time this evening. I think we've learned quite a bit, and inshallah, may Allah make it easy for anybody that's going through any sort of mental illness or illness and grant them shifa'i kamila. Ameen. But shukran for your time. Assalamu alaikum.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.